to our panel on religion and politics. We have quite an ecumenical convention up here. We almost don't have room for all of them, but it's a remarkable group of people, and I know we want to have plenty of time to hear from them and also to get your questions. And we may ask them to pray for us to stay dry, too. I will be very brief so we can get right into the discussion. We have, starting from your left, Richard Land, President of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. Then the Reverend Peter Gomes, Plummer Professor of Christian Morals and Pusey Minister at Harvard. Then we have Reverend Susan Thistlewaite, President of the Chicago Theological Seminary. Jim Wallace, founder of The Sojourner and editor-in-chief of its magazine. Peter Beinart, editor-in-large of The New Republic. Pastor Ted Haggard, president of the 30-million-member National Association of Evangelicals and pastor of the New Life Church in Colorado Springs. Elaine Pagels, the Payne Professor of the History of Religion at Princeton. And our moderator today is Nancy Gibbs, editor-at-large for Time magazine. Nancy.
I think you're already there. Okay.
We have a big panel, a big crowd, and a very big topic. So in the interest of efficiency, and since I really would like to be able to get to your questions even more than we were able to yesterday morning, I'd like to knock down a straw man so that it doesn't distract us, having to do with the notion of the separation of church and state. And I wonder if, moderator's privilege, if we can just stipulate that there is a difference between separating church and state and separating religion and politics, that we understand that American history is full of references to the Almighty, that people of faith have witnessed in the public square from the abolitionists to the prohibitionists to the civil rights movements to the arguments that are going on around us now. And so rather than talk about whether there is a role for religion in our politics and national debate, I'd like for each of us to address how religious belief should appropriately be expressed, be deployed. What are the appropriate boundaries in a pluralistic democracy for us to, as individuals, bring religion into the public square? And I guess Barbara Jordan was maybe the clearest on this when she put it to her political colleagues, are you presenting yourself as God's servant or God's spokesman? So I'd love to start with Professor Pagels, whose scholarship in biblical history I think will help us put this in context, and then just go down the line.
Well, thank you very much. Is this working? Thank you very much. I'll have to use the mic this way. You know, you put it marvelously. I really appreciate that, because as somebody who's grown up loving this country and loving the separation of politics from religion, my immigrant grandparents were very much concerned about that, having come from the Netherlands, which was torn by religious war, and recently concerned about those people who are fusing religion and politics in this country. I began to realize that that's, of course, nothing new. I mean, for most of the history of the world, religion and politics have been completely fused. The radical exception has been what we have seen in our country, some attempt to make some separation. So I began to wonder how it happened. A lot of people trace it back to the Enlightenment with the attempt to create a secular state, but it really goes thousands of years before that. When Jewish communities were settled on the boundaries of great empires like Egypt and Babylonia and Persia, politics and religion were never even imagined, even named as separate entities. But Jewish communities, surprisingly, shockingly to the people who ruled them, refused to assimilate to the religion of their conquerors. And they insisted on their own worship of God. And it was that religious conviction that was the basis of their attempt to negotiate some distancing, a little bit of wedge between what we call religion and politics. In fact, the Babylonians, Egyptians, Persians, everybody else in the history of the world who assumed that the ruler of the country, the ruler of the nation, is God's spokesman, talked about how their gods had created their rulers in the image of the God and the rulers were effectively God on earth. It's only the Jewish communities who came out with a different creation story, which said that God created human beings in the image of God. And politically speaking, this was a protest against those empires who claimed religious and political authority over their people. And we know that when the Christian movement started and was basically illegal, it created a greater wedge between the Roman Empire and the questions of religious affiliation. The only thing I want to say today is that what the basis of what we call the separation of religion and politics are religious convictions. They come out of that creation story that God created all human beings equal and so forth. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And even though the people who wrote that didn't really mean all men, they just meant Israelite men who were born free and certainly not women, we now expand that and understand all people. And so our declaration is founded, I would say, not on secular principles, but on deep religious principles. But they're principles on which people who are philosophers, atheists, agnostics, and people of any other faith can also agree.
Thank you. Pastor Ted?
Yeah, I think that's great. Very, very good. A scripture came to mind as you were speaking, and that comes out of Genesis, the 12th chapter, the second verse. And that's where God is dealing with Abraham. And, of course, all of us here in the West, we have a great appreciation for the Judeo-Christian culture that you were just speaking of, how it's gone through the ages. But he says here, "And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." Now, what was interesting about that portion of the covenant he was establishing with Abraham is that he was saying, "I'm not going to bless you just so you can be great. I'm not going to bless you just so you and yours will prosper. I'm not going to bless you just so everything about you will be wonderful." He says, "I'm going to bless you so that you can be a blessing to others." Thus, the concept of a public servant and the principle of using your strength to take care of someone else's concern. And I think as we've gone through the years, we have refined that beautifully and worked with that beautifully. Thus, when we evangelicals go to church, we call it going to the service. And our police department has strength, but on their cars we put to protect and serve. When we have a military, not under the rule of a dictator, but under the rule of an elected official that is legally elected according to a constitution, when the boy comes home excited about joining the service. And so when somebody runs for governor, they have to convince the people that they're offering public service. And so this is a very interesting idea that we're wrestling with, because there's no doubt about it. The core of a person influences what their public life is like and what they think public policy ought to be. And the core of a person is made up of their religious convictions. But interestingly enough, in this particular covenant, and I think we're seeing it as it develops, we just had the discussion about Israel and as the struggles that we have in Western civilization facing tyranny and those types of things, that we embrace so strongly this idea that we are blessed in order to be a blessing. Thus, the discussions about how to deal with the poor, how to help the poor. Thus, the discussions about civil liberties. Thus, the discussions about the rule of law. Thus, the discussions about constitutional checks and balances and those types of things. And I see so many of those things as coming from a religious base and as a positive religious base. So the great challenge is not for us as people of faith to protect ourselves, because we kind of inherently do that. A father and a mother will protect their children, etc. But the great test for us obeying this scripture and walking in the covenant that God has given us as descendants of Abraham, for those who are, is that how we can be blessed, receive what God has for us, to be the greatest blessing to those who are not in our camp, and to make life as good as possible for those who are not like us, and to make the world a better place for all of them. And so when we talk about religion and politics, that is a wonderful fusion for me. And so that's one of the reasons why I love that scripture and love many of the attributes that we are enjoying here in the West, some of the attributes are a product, of course, of our Judeo-Christian culture.
Okay, we're going to come back to something you raised, but I want to give Peter a next chance.
I just want to pick up where I think on something that Ted said, which is that at the core of what many people bring to politics in America, and has always been this way, is religion. Their religiously inspired view of what is right and wrong. And I think there's no question about that. I think that's empirically undeniable, and I think that's normatively absolutely fine. In fact, very good. I think what changes is when you speak in the public sphere. And it seems to me when you speak in the public sphere, although you may be motivated by particular religious traditions, it seems to me you have an obligation to try to speak through reason in a public voice that is in fact accessible to people of all religions and no religions. That the motivation may be deeply religious and very admirable, but when you want to, but politics is about persuasion, right? It's about politics is defined as the peaceful reconciliation of conflicting felt needs. And peaceful reconciliation of conflicting felt needs is based on persuasion. And persuasion has to persuade, you have to find a vocabulary that in a country like ours that is in fact open to people of varying religious faiths and of no religious faith. So I think the religious impetus is terrific. Where I think it becomes problematic is when you start making arguments in the public sphere that in fact are not accessible, that cannot be actually argued back and forth by people who come from a different religious tradition or from no religious tradition. I think perhaps particularly, as a Jew, I'm particularly... You particularly tend to notice this when you're not a Protestant Christian in the way that Protestant Christians may not notice. The way that certain language, which sounds extremely ecumenical, that we are all people of faith. What links us is our shared common faith. Well, actually, it turns out if you spend time in a Jewish community, particularly a traditional Jewish community, you find that people don't talk a lot about personal faith. What they talk about is law. They talk about the observance of law. There's a great story by the great sociologist Daniel Berry. He talks about when he became a socialist, basically about the time of his bar mitzvah. And he came to the rabbi and he said, I've decided I don't believe in God. And the rabbi said, who cares? Observe the law. Which is a classically kind of Jewish response. That faith, not that faith is irrelevant, but faith follows law. Very, very different than Protestantism. And so even some of the things that we assume are so nationally ecumenical, in fact, don't sound as ecumenical to non-Protestant or non-Christian ears. And the only point I would end with is it seems to me when one talks about how one finds a voice of public reason, a voice that can cross religious traditions and speak to all people, it doesn't have to be a purely utilitarian voice. It doesn't have to be the voice of statistics and numbers and policy, but it can be, and I think this is what I think was so valuable taken away from the policy from the discussion yesterday, it can be about citizenship. It can be about moral revival based on citizenship, not merely moral revival based on religion. Now, it may be religion itself that impels you, but when you're talking to the public sphere, to the country as a whole, it seems to me, you can find a language of cultural revival and moral revival, which is religiously informed, but is spoken about as terms of revival of citizenship, because that's what really binds us all together as Americans.
Now I'm going to put Reverend Wallace on the spot. Many of you know him in addition to his Sojourner's identity as the author of God's Politics, What the Right Gets Wrong and What the Left Just Doesn't Get. And so he is in much demand, particularly from Democrats who want to learn how to talk God talk. And he's very... So what I would love for you to address, if you can, and we can come back to this, is what Peter's version. We heard yesterday Dr. Land talk about how his views of abortion are anchored in Scripture and in a particular set of beliefs. If you wanted to try to give us an example of what a religiously motivated appeal in the public sphere that was expressed in the terms of citizenship and of reason and a broader common good that Peter is suggesting, what would that sound like?
Well, from the sound of the wind, it seems like the Lord wants to speak here too today, so we'll have to... Religion is such a confusing topic. My 7-year-old son Luke came up to his mom and I recently and said, Dad, Mom, I'm worried about Max and Jonah, two of his second grade pals who are on the Little League baseball team that I coach. I don't think they believe in God or Jesus. I think they're vegetarians. So we had to take him out to Oregon where he'd meet some godly vegetarians, you know. But I think as I travel the country, I don't hear a deep hunger necessarily just for a religious left now to counter a religious right. Now, there are facts that I always want to put to the table, like evangelicals aren't always right, the agenda is much broader than just two issues, and that moderate evangelicals and Catholics hold the key to America's political future, probably. Yet, I want to go deeper than that today. The country is hungry for what I would call a moral center, not a mushy political middle. Don't go left, don't go right, go deeper. What are the moral choices and challenges that lie just beneath our political discourse? And I think religion must be disciplined by democracy. Now, what I mean by that is this. Dr. King didn't say, this is a Judeo-Christian country, so I get to win. He had to make an appeal that showed that the Civil Rights Law in 1964 and Voting Rights 65 were good for all of us, not just Baptists, not just religious folk. He made an argument about what was best for the common good. Now, these panels that we're having here at Aspen, they beg a moral discourse, almost every panel. When Michael Sandel talks about the skyboxification of America, yesterday, powerful metaphor. Inequality is a deeply biblical issue, yet it has profound implications for societal health. I was in the sustainable development session, and somebody finally said to the developed countries, not the poor countries, how much is enough? Now, that's a spiritual question that goes right to the heart of the political debate. Or the left and right have, I would say, competing individualisms. The right has an individualism, kind of a market individualism. The left has a lifestyle individualism. Who speaks the language or politics of the common good? I think the role of religion is not to argue for religious self-interest or just religious liberty or specifically religious goals. Our job is to legitimate a moral discourse about politics that's accessible to all of us, whether or not we are religious. And that begs to happen in a place like Aspen. And that's a role that would be welcomed as opposed to the more divisive and intolerant sort of fear that people have about religion. And my feeling around the country is people are just begging, they're hungry for that kind of moral discourse. They want to be called to something higher or larger than their own self-interest. And that, to me, is a role for religion.
Reverend Thistle. When Nancy and I were emailing in preparation for this panel, I said that I think that faith and politics are too close now in the United States. The faith is the realm of the transcendent, and politics is the realm of compromise. The rest of what I wanted to say paled when I picked up the New York Times this morning, and I saw, and there are copies of this for you in the back, made by the staff. This is a 72-foot statue of Liberty holding a cross in one hand that's gold and the Ten Commandments in the other, put up by a megachurch in Memphis. I don't want to comment on why I think it is bad for politics to be this close to faith, other than to say that I think it is resulting in hypocrisy and a kind of public moralizing that I think has very little to do with faith. But I think it's bad for faith. This is idolatry. This is a golden calf. And I thought rather than just worshiping the Ten Commandments, it might be a good idea to actually read them. Exodus 20. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Second one is better. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above or is on earth beneath. I find the relationship between faith and politics today brittle, intolerant, and narrowing the way to God. I think we need to go back the other way. Reverend Gomes.
I have very few heroes, living or dead. Most of them, however, are dead. And one of them is Roger Williams. And I come from Plymouth, Massachusetts, the only colony out of which Roger Williams was not kicked. He was advised to leave before he would be. But Roger Williams had a concern about the relationship between church and state, and he expressed it in this way, which is the way in which I must say I find great comfort. He was not so much worried about a state that was overridden by the church as he was a church that would be overridden and interfered with by a state. And thus his view was that somehow the church or the life of faith should be protected from an interfering, manipulative, blundering, and overweening state. And thus the division, which then gets discussed later on and then becomes a part of what we understand to be Jeffersonian constitutional principles, really was designed not to protect the state from piety, but piety, or as we might put it today, a variety of pieties, from a kind of state management and manipulation. And thus I am very keen on keeping a strict separation between the interests and influences of one of these great enterprises, the communities of faith, and the community of law and authority to which we consent in the form of our civil government. And so I like the old Calvinistic notion that the function of the state was to provide a stable order within which the community of faith could flourish and do its business. And when the two are conflated, it seems to be both sides lose, and neither one has the clear mandate to carry out its responsibilities or its duties. Now, having said that, I believe in the polity that is ours in America, that the people of faith have an opportunity as well as an obligation to communicate their faith and to express the convictions that underlie their faith in the public sphere. We've been given the vote. And too much complaining has gone on recently that the people whom we oppose, some of us might oppose politically, actually went out and voted. And the rest of us sort of sat home and said, oh dear, oh me, oh my. And therefore, politics and religion don't mix. Of course they mix. And the only way that they mix properly in this country is through the exercise of the arts of persuasion and through the ballot box. So if I want my views to be heard, I want to have the kinds of judges that will be sympathetic to my point of view and may operate even on my convictions, or at least take my convictions seriously. I want a Congress that is responsible to my views. I would like even like a president whom I thought would think at all, even if he would think as I thought. I mean, I think that would be helpful. But we have this great arena out there in which we don't just have to pray for solutions, we can actually work for them and vote for them. Dr. King was very much involved in voter registration, for example. The suffrage was a very important thing. So I want to, I want to mix it up, and I think it should be mixed up there, and I think we should be engaged in the process. But I regard the government by nature as a necessary but corrupting force, and therefore I want to protect the citizenship of the believer. We're almost dual citizenship. Paul says frequently that our citizenship is in heaven, and I rather like that. I rather like belonging to something that is greater than the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or even the United States of America. I'm not just a member of an interest group, but I do have interests, and I want to be able to plead those interests and have people responsive to them. So I go back to Roger Williams. I want a stable, compassionate, and informed civil order to provide the security within which the varieties of religious experience can be expressed in their full vitality.
Well, I'm so pleased to have one of my heroes, Roger Williams, mentioned. Roger Williams believed in separation of church and state because he was concerned about the corrupting influence of the state on the church. He said there ought to be a wall of separation. That's a phrase invented by him, not Thomas Jefferson. There ought to be a wall of separation between the garden of the church and the wilderness of the state to protect the garden of the church from the encroachment of the wilderness of the state. But he also said that the garden of the church should make one of its activities to go out and to seek to domesticate more and more of the wilderness. And Roger Williams did believe in separation of church and state, and he was got in trouble for it. They were trying to banish him and even send him back to England in chains when he escaped into the New England wilderness and founded Providence Plantations, the first government anywhere in the Western world for about 1,000 years where you were free to worship as you pleased, or not to worship at all without any penalty. But the first indictment against him and the indictment that the colonial authorities had against him was, he says, we don't own our land because we got it by patent from the king and we didn't pay the Indians for it. So here is Roger Williams, the champion of separation of church and state, outraged in his Christian faith by the colonial authorities' shameful treatment of Native Americans, up to his colonial eyeballs in what was the most controversial political issue of the 17th century in New England, which was, how do we deal with Native Americans and what is the just way of dealing with Native Americans? So Roger Williams clearly didn't understand the separation of church and state to mean the separation of religiously informed moral values for religious citizens from public policy. I absolutely believe in separation of church and state because government-sponsored religion is like getting hugged by a python. It squeezes all the life out of you and you fall over dead. I don't believe in the separation of religiously informed moral values for people who are religious from public policy in the public square. As Jim was saying, Dr. King's a classic example of this. Dr. King was a Baptist minister. Dr. King's Montgomery bus boycott was started in and was led to victory by his church and members of his church and other African American churches. And he never backed up from his understanding that provided the basis for his witness to American injustice in denying to African Americans their basic civil rights. But he also made his argument not just as a religious argument, although he never backed away from the religious basis of it. He made the argument based upon this is right. It was a moral argument. This is right, and what my adversaries are doing is wrong. And it is time for the American people to rise up and to live out the promises of its founding documents, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And it seems to me that there are three ways that people in the world today are trying to organize the religious impulse in society. And the shorthand for these are Iran, France, and the United States. In Iran, it's compulsory to wear certain types of religious headgear. In France, if you want to go to public school, it's illegal. That's what I call secularism. I would call Iran theocratic government autonomy. In France, you have secularism. In Muskogee, Oklahoma, about as deep in red state country as you can get, the school district there said Muslim girls in Muskogee may wear or may not wear religious headgear in the public schools. It is purely the choice of those girls and their parents. That's what I call principled pluralism, and it seems to me that is what we should be aiming for and what is the model that most Americans would accept and should accept.
raise one other topic, and then I do want to open it to the floor. But I think that there is a perception that the current administration has crossed some boundary in its use either of religious rhetoric or application of religious belief to policy. And yet we know that, you know, Franklin Roosevelt wrote a prayer that he asked everyone to read together after D-Day, that Eisenhower asked everyone to go to church together before the Four Powers Summit. Jimmy Carter was a born-again Christian very explicitly. And so I wonder if you would address both where you think the perception comes from and whether it's based in reality about whether we are in a new place in how religion and politics are being balanced by this administration right now.
I don't think we're in a new place. I think we're in a place where, for the time being, it appears that the elected officials are in significant empathy and sympathy with a large swathe of religious opinion, and the two are working hand in hand. Now, to me, that is not a violation of a kind of unwritten separation of church and state. To me, it's an unfortunate incantation of forces with which I disagree. And I just pray that the next election it'll all be turned around. I don't think it is, I don't think a line has been crossed. I think maybe a reality has been acknowledged, and that is different. America is a much more religious country than most people are prepared to admit who define these things. And the fact that George Bush and American evangelicals are cozier than a lot of people might wish them to be is simply acknowledging the political and social facts on the ground as they are now. I go back to the anecdote in the 50s when it was decided, remember, Mr. Eisenhower was wanted by both parties as candidate for president, and the Republicans won out. And they decided that something had to be done about Mr. Eisenhower's religion or the lack thereof. So there was a great hoop to do, and your progenitor, Henry Luce, was involved in this. And they said, well, what shall we make Mr. Eisenhower? Well, we couldn't make an Episcopalian because Mr. Roosevelt was an Episcopalian. That is an aristocratic religion. You couldn't make him a Baptist because Harry Truman was a Baptist, and that is sort of too plebeian. You couldn't make him a Methodist because that was sort of ordinary from Ohio, or Methodists come from Ohio. So they had to think about what could they make. Obviously, they couldn't make him a Roman Catholic or a Buddhist or a Jew or any of those
things.
They couldn't make him a
Jehovah's Witness like his parents.
Absolutely not. So what did they do? They made him a Presbyterian. And that was the basic way that decency and order could become a part of the American religion. Now, frankly, though I think I much prefer Mr. Eisenhower to President Bush, the Bush religious relationship is much cleaner, much more honest, much more straightforward, and therefore much easier to deal with.
Dr. Land and Pastor Ted, who are both cited as two of the president's preeminent religious counselors. You want to talk to us about that?
Well, first of all, I'm not the president's religious counselor. I've known the president since 1988 and consider him a friend. But it might interest you to know, and I'm going to give you my citation for this because most of you won't believe it when I say it, but it's true. Paul Kinger, in his book, God and George W. Bush, quantifies the fact that in official speeches, Bill Clinton mentioned Jesus Christ and Christ in official speeches more every year he was president than George W. Bush has any year that he's been president, and that he actually used on two occasions the Sermon on the Mount arguing for particular pieces of legislation, implying quite clearly that if you were against this legislation, you were against the Sermon on the Mount. The reason that the secular and national media are so horrified by this, it's not George Bush talking about religion. It's his religion they don't like. It's what he's doing with it they don't like. And when Bill Clinton was doing it, they didn't mind it a bit. And so people ought to just be honest and say, you know, he's not crossed some line. He hasn't crossed the line. It's just that they don't like what he's doing with it.
Let me comment on that since you brought up what the press says about our relationship, which is not true about me either. I wish you would listen to me more. We could have all the world's problems solved. But it's very interesting that it is true that George W. Bush is an evangelical Christian, but he's a United Methodist, as I noted yesterday. And Bill Clinton regularly, in just about every single talk, when he was making an argument about anything, he'll say, we need to do the right thing. We need to do what's right. And it birthed out of his spiritual and moral convictions many times. Now, I lead the National Association of Evangelicals. We're an accumulation of 52 denominations. We have 45,000 churches in our group, plus many Christian colleges, universities, seminaries, parachurch ministries, on and on and on it goes. The Clinton administration gave the NAE absolutely everything we ever requested. Never denied us a meeting. Never denied us a ride on Air Force One to go to a particular meeting. He gave us carte blanche, everything we wanted in China policy, everything we wanted in foreign relations, everything we asked him, the Clinton administration gave us, not even close with the Bush administration. And George Bush's senior administration wouldn't even return the phone calls of the NAE. So there was no relationship at all between that administration and the NAE. It was so-so with with Jimmy Carter. It was very warm with Bill Clinton, and it's cordial with the Bush administration. And so when Richard gives this description, he is exactly right. It is a conservative liberal issue. It is not an evangelical Christian or Methodist or Baptist issue. It is a political issue.
Peter, you think that's true?
First I want to say I think that the comparison of Bill Clinton and George W. Bush in terms of how many times they mentioned Jesus is someone's apples and oranges, because Bill Clinton simply spoke so much more than George W. Bush. I don't necessarily mean that as a compliment. I mean, the man was just much, much, much more long-winded. But I actually largely agree with what Ted and Richard said. I think that the problem has been there's been a conflation between. I don't think it's just liberal versus conservative. I do think that what you've seen in the Bush administration, which many conservatives have also recognized, is a remarkable aversion, both in private and in public, to real open argument. I mean, a real tendency, in fact, to basically not admit the possibility that they could be wrong about anything, and to, in fact, engender any kind of open expression of views. A kind of a manic, closed-minded certainty, bereft of intellectual curiosity. And I think what many people have done is wrongly conflated that with George W. Bush's religiosity. Say, oh, this kind of closed-minded certainty, this lack of willingness to bring in various different people and have an open argument of things must be the product of his religiosity. I don't think it's necessarily the product of religiosity. I think that's the problem, not the religiosity itself.
Jim and then yeah. Susan.
I have said and written that I think at times George Bush has crossed some lines. I don't want to go into the cases here, but particularly around, I prefer a Solzhenitsyn or Niebuhrian notion of good and evil. Good and evil are real from a religious point of view. But if we see evil, if you can't see evil in the face of September 11th, you're suffering from some kind of postmodern relativism, I suppose. But too much of they are evil and we are good is bad theology. And I think there's been too much crossover in terms of that kind of theology. And I also think there has been sometimes too much of an identification of God's purposes with the world wants American leadership. They don't want American domination or American empire. And sometimes language I hear all over the world conflating God's purposes with our foreign policy. But I think the problem with this is not so much George Bush. When you have two pulpits on a stage, two lecterns, and the topic is religion and politics, and there's only somebody speaking in one of the lecterns, and the other one is vacant, who's ever speaking on that side controls the whole discourse. And so you're right. Democrats did come running after the election and say, hey, let's talk about religion. And when the first call came, I said, well, if you just want someone to give you some Bible verses, a few good lines from hymns, and teach you how to clap at the right time in a black church, I'm not your guy. But if you want to talk about content and moral language for political leadership, then I think we have a different conversation. Barack Obama, last week at our conference, gave, I think, the most significant address, political address, in this country on that topic, faith and politics, since Kennedy in Houston in 1960. And now I think we're at a very different place than 2004. Now the religious right doesn't own the stage. Now they share the stage, and we're having a serious conversation about what is the relation between faith and politics. And now issues like the environment as creation care are coming up. Or we had Brownback, Santorum, Clinton, and Obama at our conference last week, how poverty could become a nonpartisan issue and a bipartisan cause. Those kinds of issues end the monologue. I think the monologue of the religious right is finally over, and a new dialogue has just begun.
Susan?
I think there is a new situation. I'm not going to go anywhere near the faith of presidents. That's between them and their maker. I think what's new is the degree of organization on the ground where churches are being turned into machines to get out the vote. And this is as destructive for local churches, and I'm speaking here exclusively in the Christian context. This is as destructive of local churches as I can forcefully tell you. One of the last places we are coming together as Americans who hold different points of view, where people of conscience might be able to disagree with each other and still worship at the same table, is the church. And I know church after church, and I'm in a lot of churches because I raise money. And I'm in a lot of churches that are so fragmented, so torn apart, so unable to worship together with each other because they are being asked to be political action committees. This is an inappropriate and new use of churches, up to and including having church membership roles turned over to political parties. And if the left is going to do this, I don't want any part of it either. This is not the way we worship together, and I believe that is genuinely new, and I think it's a genuine aberration.
Yeah. I've got to respond to that respectfully. I do agree with you. It's probably inappropriate in many ways, but it is not new. The civil rights movement, much of it launched out of voter registrations in black churches, mobilization in African-American churches. There was a lot to do with the anti-war movement during the Vietnam era that took place in the Lutheran Church, the Methodist Church, the Episcopalian Church, the Presbyterian Church. They mobilized for candidates against the war movement, against the Vietnam War. Lots of the peace rallies were there. They would go directly to the city meetings and to state meetings and to federal meetings from churches. There was massive mobilization in churches during the dealing with the slavery issue on both sides of that quandary, because churches are where people gather. And so whether it's appropriate or not to turn over a mailing list or whatever, that's the debate that's got to go on amongst the leadership of the church. And I would agree with you 100% that much of that is very inappropriate. It's across the line. It goes the wrong way, but it is not new.
And I spoke out when the Bush administration called for church members in the Bush reelection campaign, asked for Bush supporters to send in church directories. I issued a public statement saying this was totally inappropriate, and said that pastors should get up in their pulpits and encourage their people not to do it, that it was a violation of the trust of the body. It was a violation of the trust of their fellow members to turn over those kinds of records. But, you know, you shouldn't blame the parties for doing this. This is what parties do. It's up to the religious leadership and the religious membership to resist it. God's not a Republican. God's not a Democrat. It's blasphemous to try to reduce God to any human invention, perhaps most of all a political party. what we're trying to do is, in the Southern Baptist Convention, is we say You should be registered to vote. It is your obligation as a citizen to be registered to vote. Second, it is your obligation to be an informed voter. And when you vote, you should vote your values, your beliefs, and your convictions, and you should be looking for candidates who endorse you, and the church should not be endorsing candidates. I think that we lower ourselves when we get involved in that way. But is there going to be a political aspect to religious values and public policy? Of course there is, because that's how we decide things in the United States. We have a robust and healthy debate. In 1854, 4,000 New England clergy issued a petition to the United States Senate calling for the abolition of slavery. Stephen Douglas said this was a violation of the First Amendment, it was a violation of the Constitution, and that these ministers had forsworn their rights as citizens when they became clergymen. And one of my personal heroes, General Sam Houston, who was then a senator from Texas, a pro-unionist governor of Texas, got up and said, well, you know, he said, I don't think that's right. He said, these people are citizens, and just because they're members of the clergy, they haven't forfeited their rights as citizens. They have just as much right to petition this body for redress of grievances as does any other group. No more right, but no less right.
I think what's genuinely new is the Internet. The degree of organization, and it's on both sides. I mean, we had a peace movement like that. It took 6 years in the Vietnam War of standing on street corners with candles singing, all we are saying is give peace a chance. We had it 20 minutes later, we had a peace movement. I think the degree of organization is a factor that the Internet has introduced, but I think it is being used particularly perniciously in this time.
Can I? Well, my concern on this is simply that if you look at this superficially and casually, as we are often tempted to do, it is usually the side that loses that complains about the crossing of lines. And it strikes me that and since the side that I often represent has lost consistently in recent times, that the solution is not simply to cry foul or to decry the success of those of whom we disapprove, but to be better organized and to get those people out. The only solution is to turn the rascals out. Life changes. Politics is a vibrant, engaging enterprise in this country. To insert the Bible in this, those who are on top today may not be on top tomorrow. You have your reward. So let us see what happens, and let's stop complaining, and let's just get out there and see if we can do better than they can. That's the American way.
Peter and I were laughing over here talking about what is new, and we think what's new is Karl Rove.
Yes.
See, because Karl Rove did what the professor just described. Karl Rove organized the right in churches for the first time. The left had been, now the right has been, and now we're going to see what happens in the future. It's going to be a great experiment.
Yes, sir.
Adam Taylor, I think there's a perception that the right, or conservative evangelicals in particular, have narrowed the political agenda to just a few issues. And I've been encouraged, actually, by the Health of the Nation document that the National Association of Evangelicals just released. But my question really is to Reverend Haggard and Dr. Land. I would still argue that both of your constituencies, if you will, have a great deal of access and influence with both Congress and this administration. We can debate how much, but I think it's pretty substantial. And my question to both of you is whether you are willing to invest the same kind of political capital that I think your constituencies have put into issues of life, of being pro-life, issues around gay marriage and a ban on gay marriage, as I think we can and should be putting in to the fight against poverty, issues around the environment, etc. Given that 37 million Americans live in poverty, there's been a 4-year increase in that number. Given the 3 billion people live on less than $2 a day, how are your constituencies and how are you providing leadership to prioritize poverty in terms of your political capital?
Great. Very, very good question. And that's why the NAE did release the Health of the Nation document, which I would encourage you to get a copy of. And that's why Jim has this document out here, A Covenant for a New America, about poverty and opportunity. And what we are aggressively, very aggressively trying to do is place these other issues on the agenda. At the headquarters for the Southern Baptist Convention and the NAE, these issues are regularly discussed. Sex trafficking, the Dofor problem, AIDS, poverty issues, millions of dollars spent, lots of resources expended, but they are not the hot button issues. And we're trying to make, like, environmental discussion. We call it creation care. We believe God created the heavens and the earth. We're made in His image and likeness. We have a responsibility to the heavens and the earth to care for them. They're on loan to us from God. And so we have a responsibility to have an environmental concern. That is increasingly becoming a radar screen item for the evangelical community. And that's why we're releasing these documents. That's why we're talking about them. That's why we're getting on the press all we can about it. And because we don't want that to be, we feel like the conservative evangelicals, by conservative evangelical, I mean theologically conservative evangelical, person that believes the Bible is the Word of God. I'm not talking about political affiliation, all right? So a conservative evangelical, we believe that strength needs to be added to the environmental movement for it to get for it to reach tipping point so it's effective. Because evangelicalism is exploding in Asian Pacific Rim countries, South America, Central America, and Africa. With those people lined in to invite, and they're also highly impacted by environmental problems. And so with them lined up into the environmental concern, then we can have a much larger body of people concerned and involved, and that's what we're trying to do. And we appreciate your efforts helping with that. Okay.
Yeah. He asked me the question.
I'm sorry.
Well.
Can I go? Can you be really quick? Because I would love to get in a couple more questions.
This is the Baptist Faith and Message. This is our official confession of faith, which I was on the revision committee of. All Christians are under obligation to seek to make the will of Christ supreme in our own lives and in human society. Means and methods used for the improvement of society among men can be truly and permanently helpful when they are rooted in the regeneration of the individual and should be voluntary. In the spirit of Christ, Christians should oppose racism, every form of greed, selfishness, and vice, and all forms of sexual immorality. We should work to provide for the orphaned, the needy, the abused, the aged, the helpless, and the sick. We should speak on behalf of the unborn and contend for the sanctity of all human life from conception to natural death and everywhere in between. Of course, we should be concerned about these issues, and we're working to be concerned about these issues, and many of our constituencies are concerned about these issues. But it strikes me that there's a difference between focus and narrowing. Accusing evangelicals of being narrowed to just the sanctity of human life issue is, it seems to me, like criticizing Dr. King for supposedly being preoccupied with racial justice and racial reconciliation. As long as 3,600 human beings die every day in the United States, we don't apologize for making that a focus.
Thank you, Daniel Benjamin. I'm delighted to have heard so much Judeo-Christian comedy. It seems to me that one of the most critical issues facing us is actually in the religious sphere how we deal with the faith not represented on the dais, which is the largest, fastest growing one in America, and also the one that is typically seen as being on the other side of the war on terror. For those of us who spend some time looking at Christian evangelical websites, there's been a remarkable rise in Islamophobia. The former president of the Southern Baptist Convention described Muhammad as a demon-obsessed pedophile. Pat Robertson,
Granted, Islam is a violent religion, and Muhammad is a wild-eyed fanatic, a robber, a brigand, a killer. And Pastor Ted, you yourself were quoted in Harper's as saying that your fear is that your children will grow up in an Islamic state. So I guess my question here is this a sensible way of going about dealing with 1.2 billion people with whom we have to find an accommodation? And is it a misapprehension to say that there is, as the polls would suggest, a rising Islamophobia on the right?
Well, I disagree with Jerry Vines and Pat Robertson at the time that they said that. They're big boys and they can defend themselves. I think both of those statements are wrong. I think that we need to understand that Islam is a many splintered thing, for starters. And that the most optimistic estimates by people who are radical Islamic jihadists is that somewhere between 10 to 15% of the people who are followers of Islam in the world are sympathetic with radical Islamic jihadism. And we do need to remember that for every American that has been killed in Iraq by radical Islamic jihadists, there have been about 10 Muslims who have been killed by radical Islamic jihadists. I think that we have to deal with Islam with respect. As I pointed out in my principal pluralism model, followers of Islam should have every right to participate equally in this society and to express their faith and to bring their faith convictions to bear on public policy as long as they, like everyone else, agrees to play by the rules. And the rules are you can't coerce anyone else into your faith, and you can't kill people who disagree with you, and you can't throw people in jail who disagree with you. And followers of Islam who accept that are perfectly willing they should be welcomed into our society and have been welcomed into our society. I do think it would help if followers of moderate Islam were more vocal in their denunciation of radical Islam. A year ago, February, in the Washington Post, there was a front-page article about a school for Islamic diplomats from Islamic countries in Arlington, Virginia, within sight of the Capitol, that had as its civics textbook that the world would not end until the Christians broke the cross and accepted Islam and until all the Jews were killed. Now, I can tell you that if there was a Christian school teaching anything remotely similar to that from a Christian perspective, we would be demonstrating with placards around that school and going on television to make sure that everyone in America knew that these people did not speak for the Christian faith. The absence of that has been troubling to many in America of all faiths.
I think that this question is very important, but a number of us could tell stories about how we're having a lot of conversations now with those people. We do town meetings across the country, and they're evangelicals, Catholic, mainline black church, but also rabbis and young Muslims, a rising number of young Muslims who tell me they're in a battle for the heart and soul of their own religion. And Reza Aslan's one name I would commend to you. Read his book, No God But God. It's a very articulate statement of somebody trying to battle for, some of us have felt that our faith, Christian faith, has been hijacked sometimes by a religious fundamentalism, and we say we want to take it back. Well, I know young Muslims now who feel like their faith's been hijacked too, and they want to take it back, and we have to give them all the support we possibly can.
When we talk about, I mean, I perfectly agree with you about not killing people who disagree with you, but I haven't heard people talk about starting a war as a moral issue today. And I think there are many people who feel that the starting of the Iraq War was an ill-advised issue, and it was depicted, in fact, as a religious war. I've spent much of my life as a Christian in Muslim countries working in archaeology and history. And, you know, I think, as you know, the Congress and many others agreed with invading Afghanistan. But going into Iraq as if it were a Christian cause and turning the Muslim world against us in the way that this ill-advised action has, I think is a huge moral issue.
Obviously, all of us are perplexed with how to talk to a journalist about
a complex issue like this, knowing that one sentence will be in print. And I was actually relieved when the one sentence that ended up in print was that my fear is that my children will grow up in an Islamic state. He could have taken some of the other sentences, meaning where I talked about we embrace pluralistic, what I call secular society, which doesn't mean atheistic society, secular society where you have reasonable debate, open discussion, rule of law, laws written by citizens, a constitution, independent judiciary, things like that. It is my desire that my children grow up in a state that embraces those values. Now, I don't care what the percentages are so much in that whether there's a high Jewish population or Islamic population or Christian population or Buddhist population or what, as long as there's representative government, elected officials, rule of law, independent judiciary, and some of those values. So when I said that, that wasn't a comment on Islamic people. That was in a comment on what Islamic fundamentalists want to institute as Islamic government.
Susan.
Should there be a Muslim on this panel? Yes, and more than one. Because, as Jim rightly points out, they're as pluralistic as we are, and there's far greater pluralism than we represent. It's also my experience in panels like that. Are you allowed to assign homework at the Aspen Institute? I have homework for you. Google us. Google us. Read our stuff. There's a tendency to homogenize dialogue and get along. You might find more diversity on this panel if you read people's published statements. It will, in fact, be a good exercise of follow-up anyway. There's no exam.
Mr. Krauss.
Lawrence Krauss. The other thing that I thought wasn't really represented by the panel so far is that when it comes to religion and politics, one of the areas where they often lead to conflicts has to do with science. And maybe I'm speaking like a loser, Peter, but... What concerns me is there's been a great deal of discussion of the fact that public policy should be based on morality. But the other thing it's vitally important to be based on is physical reality. And there are, and for scientists, there's a great concern when the people's moral basis is based on things that are patently, demonstrably false, empirically. Dr. Land and I have debated on TV, that, and as he pointed out, as he argued, he felt that from his interpretation, for example, evolution, the Bible says evolution is wrong. What do we do
not
as scientists? Well, that's what I interpreted.
What I
but in any case, yesterday he said, for example, that abstinence is a good policy, in spite of the fact that another evangelical, Jimmy Carter, has written extensively about the fact that if we're interested in reducing abortion, societies which have open access to abortion and sex education, which is based on things that work and not don't work, lead to fewer abortions. That's physical reality. So the question is, how can the scientific community, without appearing anti-religious, deal with this effort on behalf of some organizations to distort public policy? Should we say, for example, that they should leave the Southern Baptist Convention and join another evangelical group, or what should we do?
Maybe science should revert to its old habits and become anti-religious again, because it's more consistent with the point of view. You should start making nice. In other words, if you have firm convictions and you feel that the battle for evolution really ought to be addressed again and not simply rely on the victory in 1925, you ought to do it, because you can't rely on sort of weak-kneed clergy who are ill-informed or who are biased one way or the other to do that. We are a country that still gives great deference to scientific opinion. All we have to do is say science shows, or a scientific survey, or a scientific this, that, or the other, even if it's made up out of whole cloth, people will take it very seriously. And so I think nothing is to be gained by your backing off and hoping that religion will come to its senses and stop trying to make the book of Genesis a scientific textbook. Religions won't do that, by and large. It's in their interest not to do that. I do not trust my co-religionists in scientific matters. They are uninformed, they are biased, and they are simply relying on 19th century self-defense mechanisms. What we need are passionate, informed, articulate, dare I say it, humane scientists who will not back off and who will keep presenting these matters in a way that the broad American public will be able to understand it and respect it. There is a sort of warfare between science and religion. We have different interests. We do have different worldviews. But in most scientific worldviews, I think you're better than we are. We'll only know at the end, but I'm voting with you.
I am going to leave it at that because we're over time, but thank you very much.